Hi there, this is the podcast Health Check from the BBC with the latest health and medical research. I'm Claudia Hammond and I have my trusty cup of tea with me in the studio to perk me up. But a new study conducted in embassies in Iceland and Latvia suggests that maybe more light is what I need.
If you can't have daylight, you can do it with electric lighting. If you can't do it with electric lighting, you should pick up your laptop and go sit by a window or go sit in a place outdoors maybe. Do conference calls outside, do walking meetings outside.
And can stimulating the spinal cord in the right way ease back pain? And it's welcome back to James Gallagher, the BBC's health and science correspondent, who has news of the discovery, possibly, of a brand new organ in the body and why rubber ducks in the bath might not be the healthy option at bath time. Do you have any in your bath, James?
I have a collection of rubber ducks plus a dolphin, a turtle, an octopus and a pufferfish.
And is that just since you had your baby girl or did you have those all along?
They are since Amelia arrived.
Okay.
Although, in fairness, I am really enjoying them.
Okay, well, that's good if you can all enjoy them. First today, if you've ever had flu, and I mean real flu, not just a stinking cold, you'll know that at the worst points, you really feel as if you're dying. And of course, sometimes it can kill. But new research has found that if you've just had flu or pneumonia, you could be at greater risk for the next few days or weeks of a heart attack or stroke. I asked Charlotte Warren-Gash, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, what gave her the idea for exploring this connection.
There are studies right back in the 1930s that show interesting patterns of circulation of flu viruses and heart attacks. So you see these big peaks in the winter of both heart attacks and of flu. So we wondered, is there a relationship or is it just something maybe to do with cold weather, temperature, something like that? We've previously done some work using data from Hong Kong, which is interesting because that's a subtropical climate, so they've got different patterns of flu circulation. So in Hong Kong, you see two peaks of flu viruses every year.
So to try to work out what's going on, you got hold of data that's been collected of people in Scotland where you can see exactly who's had a heart attack and who's had flu before that.
That's right. We have medical records of people who went to hospital with a heart attack or stroke. And we also had, linked to that, records of any respiratory infections they had. So these are laboratory confirmed infections with specific viruses like influenza virus and bacteria like strep pneumonia, which is a common cause of pneumonia.
So presumably those would be quite serious infections if they'd been confirmed in a lab. It's not somebody who's staying at home with flu, say, and not seeing a doctor.
No, absolutely. So all these people had gone to doctors, but even then, most people who go to the doctor don't have a test for respiratory infections. So this is definitely the more severe end of the spectrum. And it might even be people who went to hospital with their infection.
And what did you find? Were people more likely to have a heart attack or a stroke after they'd had flu?
Absolutely. So we saw that some confirmed respiratory infections were linked to an increased risk of heart attack and stroke. It was a temporary increase, so the increased risk was about six times greater, and it lasted around a week for heart attack, and it lasted a bit longer for stroke, roughly a month. But I think it's important to keep this in context. So if we think about people in Scotland, where the study was conducted, each week we'd expect around two heart attacks for every 10,000 people who are in the over 75 age group. So we know that in the week after respiratory infection, that figure would rise to about 10 heart attacks.
So what do you think the mechanism could be? Is it just that people are feeling weaker because they just have flu and they're recovering from that or from some other respiratory infection, and so somehow the heart attack or stroke then gets them?
Well, there are several theories about mechanisms. One is that some of these particular bugs, like strep pneumonia, can actually have direct effects on the heart muscle. Another theory is a more general effect of infection. So when you have an infection, your body tends to be more inflamed. That can lead to effects on blood clotting and can actually predispose to the blood clots that cause heart attacks and strokes. So I think it could be a combination of mechanisms.
So even though the risk isn't that much greater when you put it in context, it is worrying for people. If you've had flu or some other infection, this is going to be worrying. What can people do about it?
Well, I think it's important to emphasise these results are particularly relevant to older people, so people aged over 65, and also maybe younger people with pre-existing heart disease, because those people are all at higher risk of heart attacks and strokes anyway. So for those two particular groups I've mentioned, there are influenza vaccines and pneumococcal vaccines which are recommended. We know that vaccine uptake isn't always high, particularly for younger people. So knowing about this link with heart attacks and strokes might be an added incentive to get vaccinated. And there are other things that people can do to reduce their risk of heart attacks and strokes more generally. So having a healthy lifestyle, maintaining a healthy weight, not smoking, not drinking to excess, for example, can all help to reduce your risk of heart attacks more generally.
So you were saying that in Hong Kong there are these two peaks of seasonal flu. Do they also then see two peaks of people having heart attacks and stroke?
Interestingly, they do. And we actually did some work a few years ago now with the University of Hong Kong, and we built some statistical models where we controlled for other factors like the effect of temperature, the effect of humidity. And even once you got rid of those effects, there was still this link between circulation of respiratory viruses and heart attacks and strokes.
And would you say this is something that doctors know about or have had an inkling about before you've demonstrated it with the data here?
Well, I think what we knew before was that flu-like illnesses more generally were linked to an increased risk of heart attack. What this study adds is the specific bugs. It's not always easy to link data on particular organisms with hospital records data. So this really pinpoints the effect of particular bugs. And it's not just one organism. It seems to be influenza, Streptococcus pneumonia. There are also a range of other respiratory confirmed viruses which might induce a slight increase in risk. But we know less about those other viruses and they're less common. So I think that's an area for future research.
Charlotte Warren-Gash. Now, James, you have some good news for us today about using stem cells to try to cure age-related macular degeneration, which is the third most common cause of blindness in the world. Now, they have tried using stem cells in eyes before, haven't they?
Yeah, the idea is that when you have some forms of blindness, it's cells dying, some of the cells that sense light or the ones that keep those light-sensing cells alive die. And so the idea of stem cells is, well, if you put those in, maybe they'll replace the cells that have died and restore sight. Now, trials before now have just injected those stem cells into the eyeball, into the fluid in the eyeball, in the hope that they'll get to the right place. This technology that's been developed by Moorfields Eye Hospital in London is quite different. It basically builds in the laboratory the bit of the eye that is needed. So you use the stem cells to grow a patch. It's only one cell thick, but it's still visible to the naked eye. It's about 6 millimetres, so half a centimetre long, but it's only one cell thick. So it's really delicate. And then that gets placed in the very particular part of the eye that it needs to be. So it's a very different approach.
And they just tried this out on two patients. So did it work?
It did, remarkably. So in age-related macular degeneration, the sweet spot of the retina is the bit at the back of your eye that actually detects light. The sweet spot there is called the macula. And that's when you read a book or watch TV, it's your macula that you're using. Now, the light-sensing cells there are supported by something called the retinal pigment epithelium. Remember all your
very
big
good
words today, Claudia. And that's what they rebuilt in the laboratory, a new retinal pigment epithelium. And that was placed inside the retina at the backs of these patients' eyes, in these two patients. And both of them went from basically being practically blind in that eye to being able to read again. I mean, they're reading, you know, quite large text. It's not the smallest newspaper print in the world, but they are reading again for the first time. One of the patients on the trial was describing how he can actually look his wife in the face again. I mean, it has had a truly remarkable impact on these patients' lives.
And this patient was called Douglas, and he's 86. It sounds quite old to be having an experimental treatment.
What happened in Douglas's case is he had a catastrophic bleed in the back of his eye, which was going to severely damage his macula and his retina, so that he would be permanently blind in that eye unless they acted. So doctors saw an opportunity to try this technology on him as part of the trial.
Now, of course, it's great for these two patients and it's really clever, but with all these pioneering treatments, what we always want to know, of course, is when it will be available to more people and where it will be available. Is this something we're ever going to see all around the world?
Well, the first thing doctors need to do is finish this safety trial. So another eight patients are going to take part in that. But the team think that within 3 to 5 years, this will be a treatment that will be available to patients. But there is an elephant in the room, and that really is, how much is it going to cost? Now, let me give you a different example. Cataract surgery is incredibly simple, and yet cataracts are the biggest cause of blindness around the world because large numbers of people don't have access to such simple treatment. Now, this therapy is infinitely more complicated, infinitely more costly than cataract surgery. So what does that mean if you're in sub-Saharan Africa, remote parts of Southeast Asia or South America? It means this isn't going to arrive anytime soon.
Thanks, James. Now, pain is a huge global health problem. Every year, 1 in 10 adults is diagnosed with chronic pain. That's pain lasting longer than 12 weeks. And back pain is the most common kind. For decades now, there have been attempts to alleviate the pain by delivering small electrical fields to the spinal cord, known as spinal cord stimulation or neuromodulation. And the idea is to change the pain signals that the body is sending to the brain. Now doctors at Guy's Hospital in London have tweaked the technology to try to make it more effective. Health Check reporter Bobby Lacera went to see an operation in action.
Kelly, how do you feel?
Fine.
As soon as you feel buzzing sensation in the back,
yeah,
let me know.
Mm-hmm. Consultant in pain medicine Adnan Al-Kaisi is operating on patient Kelly Lamley, who suffers from chronic back pain. Mr. Al-Kaisi is implanting a specialised wire into her spine.
Kelly, if I put my hand, do you feel buzzing here under my hand?
Slightly down.
Can we just increase the intensity a little bit more, please? So we're covering the back and both legs at the moment.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
To check it's fitted on the part of her spinal cord where her pain originates from, they wake Kelly up during the operation. Mr. Al-Kaisi told me more about how it works.
The system is activated by external power battery, delivering a small voltage of electricity to the affected part of the spinal cord. This electricity will generate electromagnetic field, which will go on the nerves which carrying the pain impulses to the brain.
You've been performing this operation for 20 odd years.
Yes.
So what is this latest take on this operation that you feel is making a change?
Well, there is, over the last 10 years or so, two things happening. Number one is our understanding on the neurophysiology of how these messages of pain coming from peripherally to centrally. And number two is improvement in implant technology, that they're creating electromagnetic field on the spine where the pain is, without the patient feeling any buzzing sensation in their body.
Spinal cord stimulation is for patients with severe chronic pain that limits their daily life, and for whom other therapies such as painkillers and physiotherapy aren't working. Kelly's problems began 14 years ago after a horse riding accident.
As soon as you wake up, the first thing you do is get your medication, and then just slowly get dressed. You've got to take everything really slowly.
So you're really limited in,
yeah,
in what,
yeah,
you can
and
do.
As soon as the pain starts, then you have to sit down and stop for a while and until your painkillers kick in, and then you can start again.
What treatment have you had so far?
Steroid injections. I've also had operations and lots of tablets. Oromorph for about 10 years.
And is that quite a strong painkiller?
That's a really strong painkiller, yes. Plus morphine tablets. You have to take more painkillers to get through each day.
On a scale of 1 to 10, what is your pain currently?
At the moment, we're probably on about sort of 9 today.
So it's proper, it's top level.
It's always, yeah, but you learn to live with it. It's part of your life.
Kelly? Yeah. Okay, I'm just increasing the amplitude. Okay. So if you feel any buzzing, which we call tingling, yeah, let me know, please.
Kelly is one of 5 patients with chronic back pain Mr. Al-Kaisi will operate on today. Studies looking at the global impact of lower back pain have found it's the leading cause of limited activity and work absence throughout much of the world. Mr. Al-Kaisi told me how it's a complaint he's seeing more and more.
Probably is a modern life. We don't pay attention to the way we sit, the way we stand, lack of exercise, the trans in the family. The patients get depressed, they get anxiety. Potentially, they can lose their job and has effect on their beloved one as well.
I asked Kelly before the operation, on a scale of 1 to 10, where is her pain? She said 9. What are you keen to see after the operation?
Well, we are hoping this 9 to go to a 3 or even 2.
So really a significant reduction.
Absolutely. We will help the patients to reduce their current pain relief medication, which clearly have a very little effect on their pain. But patients tend to keep taking this medication. So it would be cost-effective for us to reduce, obviously, the cost of the medication, to reduce the patient's visit to the center or to the GP. So, and we managed to bring a lot of these patients back to work. And then we are looking forward to conduct a bigger study for patients who never had surgery before. And that's what we think the bigger problem that we are going to face in modern life, these with the chronic, severe lower back pain. I think in the future, this therapy will replace spinal surgery for a patient who is suffering from neuropathic lower back pain.
So we're covering the back and both legs at the moment?
Yes, yeah.
And we are not missing any part?
No.
Of the pain?
No, not in the CL.
That's great.
The surgery has been a success, so the team finish up.
So at this stage, the patient has confirmed that the buzzing sensation is covering where the pain is, and anaesthetist is going to put her back to sleep.
Kelly, it's been 3 months since your operation, and I just think you look like a totally different person.
Thank
you. Striding into the restaurant towards me. So how have you been feeling?
Absolutely fantastic. It's like a new life, a whole new life.
With the pain increasing, your drug regime is increasing as well.
Yes. I've dropped down more than half.
More than half?
And I have no Oramorph, none whatsoever now.
And that was the really strong painkiller.
That was the really strong liquid, yes. That was the worst one.
And how quickly did you notice the difference?
The actual pains in my legs. The next day, you could feel a huge difference straight away. It was brilliant. And you just feel free.
I remember asking you on a scale of 1 to 10, where was your daily pain? And you said 9.
Yes.
And where would you score now?
Now, I would say, if you'd done an average, 2.
2?
Yes. It's a miracle. It's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Bobby Lacara reporting. Now, James, you'd think that with all the many thousands of bodies that have been dissected by now and all the advances there have been in scanning, that every part of the human anatomy had been discovered. But I don't know if you remember, was it last year, the discovery of
January
a new...
January last year.
Yeah, January last year, a new little tiny organ in the gut. And now there might be another one called the interstitium. So what is this?
Well, the idea of the interstitium is that it's some of those connective tissues that we've known about for a long time, but looking at it in more detail and realising it might be more complicated and have a greater role than we ever thought before. Now, this is around every organ, in parts of organs, in between muscles, around blood vessels. And it's a little bit like a sponge. So it's kind of a marbled series of fluid-filled sacs all joined together. And the idea is it acts as a bit of a shock absorber, but also it may have a role in some diseases because the fluid in between those little pockets seems to flow as well. And so there has been some speculation that might be involved in how cancers spread. But it's very early days in terms of deciding whether this is actually a new organ or not.
And did we actually not know this was there before?
Well, we knew there was something there, but what has happened since is using a different type of microscopy that actually allowed scientists to look at the living tissue that was there. Because normally, if you think about it, we're not looking for a heart or a liver or a kidney. We're looking for something that's like a layer of tissue all over the body. And so it required a different way of looking in the first place in order to be able to see what was actually there rather than destroying it. Because many forms of microscopy, in order to take your sample and stain it in order to be able to see it, it changes the tissue that's there. And so that's how these doctors have seen what's there.
And it's kind of a gap, really, isn't it? So then there's the question of whether you can count a gap as an organ, really.
The definition of an organ can be quite vague at some times. You know, you kind of go from single cells up to tissues, which are all kind of like cells of the same type, and then up to organs, a collection of tissues that have a role within an organism, and that's where the word comes from. So if it has a specific role, then I think you probably could classify it as an organ.
Thanks, James. Now, I don't know about you, but in the office in the mornings, I need at least one cup of tea to keep me going. And I know plenty of people who use coffee to perk them up. But new research conducted in the gloomy offices in US embassies in Iceland and Latvia suggests that better lighting might do the trick instead. Dr. Mariana Fruguero is from the Lighting Research Center at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in New York State.
The U.S. Department of State was receiving complaints from the people posted there saying that they really were unhappy with how dark things were in these embassies. So we started with a small study really looking at, would people feel perkier, more alert, if they had better circadian light during the day at work?
So in the pictures, there's a light that's like a strip across the top of their computer screens. And is that supposed to simulate, is that daylight kind of light?
Well, it is not really a daylight type, but it is a light that delivers a strong stimulation to your biological clock. So we know that the biological clock is more sensitive to short wavelength or blue light, and we tend to have warmer color lights in the built environment. So the idea was to provide that more bluish white light, but it didn't have as much intensity as we typically have outdoors.
So what did you find? Did you find that people did feel perkier if they had this light?
They did, in 4 different parts of the world, one in Virginia, one in Vermont, one was in Reykjavik in Iceland, and one was in Riga, Latvia. And all 4 buildings have had very similar results. We collected 1 day of baseline with the lights off, and then 2 consecutive days with the lights on. And we probe their alertness and their vitality and energy scores four times during the day. All four buildings showed they felt perkier and more alert.
Now, obviously, a two-day intervention is quite short, really. Can we really tell that much from how it worked for just 2 days? That can't really tell us, can it, whether the light would be beneficial over a much longer time period?
Yes, we would not be able to say whether that light would be beneficial on their sleep patterns, because it does take a few days for you to see the benefits on the sleep patterns. And that was one of the reasons why we didn't measure sleep, because we were doing a short-term exposure. But in terms of the acute alerting effects, that effect is very quick. In fact, when we measure electroencephalogram, which is EEG or brain activities in laboratory conditions, we see this alerting effect after 15, 20 minutes of the light exposure. So the follow-up project that we just completed, we looked at 2 weeks of the intervention instead of 2 days. To look at the impact of that light on sleep measures, you need longer periods.
And can we be sure it just wasn't some kind of, I don't know, almost some kind of placebo effect, that they liked the attention they were getting? Did you compare it with offices that weren't having these lights to see what difference there was?
No, we prefer to do what we call a within subjects design. And absolutely, there's always a possibility that it was a placebo effect. But we saw the biggest impact on the third day, so 2 days after the intervention was turned on. If it were a placebo effect, I would expect to see, you know, improvement in the responses right at the first day that we turned on the lights. And we didn't see that. And the second thing is that this is very consistent with what we see in laboratory studies. So it's reasonable to expect that that could be translated into the field. And I think the third and more important thing is that we saw similar results in all four different buildings in four different parts of the world.
Do you know what the mechanism is? What is it that the light is doing that's making people feel more alert?
We actually are currently collecting some laboratory studies looking at functional MRI, putting people on a scanner to see if we can understand that. And my hypothesis really is that that light is basically affecting what we call their homeostatic sleep pressure. It's basically, you know, you wake up in the morning, you have no sleep pressure because you just got up. And then as the day goes by, you accumulate hours awake, you accumulate sleep pressure. Caffeine sort of blocks the receptors in the brain that interprets that sleep pressure so that it reduces the amount of sleep pressure that you have. I think lighting is doing the same thing.
So what should people learn from this? Should we all take care to make sure that the offices we're working in are lighter and, I don't know, open the blinds and get whatever light we can?
Absolutely. I have to say, one of the things that I'm learning with these studies is that I think we work in very, very dim environments. And if you can't have daylight, you can do it with electric lighting. If you can't do it with electric lighting, you should pick up your laptop and go sit by a window or go sit in a place outdoors, maybe do conference calls outside, do walking meetings outside. I think we should not waste energy. We should save the planet. But I also think that ultimately lighting is for people. And if we're keeping people in the dark, meaning in the biological darkness, that could result in loss of productivity or people getting sleepier and people interrupting their work because they need some countermeasures. So I think there's a huge potential for improving lighting in the built environment, especially in office spaces, to promote that cup of coffee effect.
Mariana Fragero. This is Health Check from the BBC with me, Claudia Hammond, and James Gallagher is my guest today. So maybe no more coffee for you, James.
Well, you know, I'm a tea person anyway, so that just showed how little you know me. And two, you can have whatever fancy light bulb you want. You're not coming anywhere near my mug of tea.
Fair enough. Now, there are headlines before we go in the paper today saying, dirty secret, rubber ducks are so filthy they can kill. And I like this one, yucky ducky. So
it's good, isn't it?
What is wrong with rubber ducks in the bath?
I think one of the problems with rubber ducks is that they often have little valves in them, so they stay full of air and they can float, and then you can squeeze them.
And you can squeak them.
And you can squirt water in your children's faces if you're so way inclined.
Mm. I think they're supposed to squirt it at you, actually, but yeah.
Oh, is that which way around it is? Don't tell Mum. But that's an area that you don't clean particularly. And so what scientists have done is they've cut open some rubber ducks and seen quite how much gunk is in there, and then done some laboratory testing of it and found things like Legionella and Pseudomonas in there. And these would be potentially disease-causing bacteria. I would say that we don't have a huge spate of children dying from Legionnaires' disease after bath times. So quite how big the impact is, uncertain.
But this research was done by real doctors. Or were they quacks?
I can't even reply to that. This was done by the Swiss Federal Institute of Aquatic Science and Technology with colleagues at the University of Illinois. So it was a real piece of research. It was published in the journal Biofilms and Microbiomes. Nothing to do with rubber ducks.
They looked at rubber crocodiles as well, I noticed.
Well, this is one of the things that seems to fuel the growth of different species is the material that your little bath toy is made of. And so some rubber ducks are made from something and release small amounts of like carbon and other chemicals that the actual bacterium can feed off, which didn't seem to be present in the crocodiles. Apparently, I can't pronounce crocodiles.
But you can get mildew-resistant ducks. They sell them in the shops.
They can. Are they the ones that don't have a hole in?
Oh, well, that's
I think
no
some
fun.
Of them do,
that's
don't,
no fun
don't have
if it hasn't
the squeaker.
Got the hole.
Yeah.
So, are you going to be taking all your bath toys out of the bath, or is it all water off a duck's back to you?
Oh! I'm not going to change anything.
Fair enough. Thank you very much, James Galler, for joining us today. Paula McGrath is the producer of Health Check from the BBC. Next week, we will have the tale of the British doctor who's led research into preventing certain types of cancer from being passed on through families. And on Saturday, do listen out for the new series, The Evidence, when I'll be in South Africa discovering how doctors are working with traditional healers to get more people tested for HIV. I'm on Twitter, @ Claudia Hammond. Bye for now.